Hi, this is Richard Eyre. I'm a director of theatre, opera, and movies. I have made a TV film of The Dresser, and I'll be talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By.
Oh, shalom, shalom, my friends. This is your old pal, Rabbi Saul Solomon. And you all know, if you've heard me on this radio program, just how much I love the theater. And boy, oh boy, if you're talking about high echelons of theater, you can't get much higher than the guest we have on the radio program today. This man was the associate director of Edinburgh's Royal Lyceum Theatre and then spent a decade as director of the National Theatre right in London. His list of actors that he has directed is like a who's who. Daniel Day-Lewis, Eve Best, Bob Hoskins, Jonathan Pryce, Paul Scofield, Eileen Atkins, and also Sir Anthony Hopkins. He's directed movies, including Notes on a Scandal. He wrote a book and a documentary about the theater called Changing Stages. And you may have seen Mary Poppins on Broadway. He directed that. He directed the original Skylight. He directed The Crucible with Laura Linney and Liam Neeson. My gosh, and even more than that, our guest Richard Eyre is a knight. I'm not even an afternoon. So ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to me this mere commoner, Sir Richard Eyre. Shalom to you.
Shalom, Rabbi. I feel honored by your introduction.
Well, I feel honored with your presence. Let's get to the thing that you are currently doing, because if I were to talk to you 6 months from now, you'd be talking about something completely else on your plate. But right now, we're talking about the video release of The Dresser, which is, if people may remember that play, or it was a movie about 20, 30 years ago, but you've done a new one for English television with Sir Anthony Hopkins, and is Ian McKellen a sir as well? Do you know?
He is a sir.
They're both sirs.
As is Ronald Harwood, who is the writer.
Why did you choose, you've done a lot of Shakespeare for British TV.
I've done a lot of Shakespeare, and I've also, I directed King Lear nearly 20 years ago with Ian Holm. And if you ask why did I do this version of The Dresser, it's quite simple, because of Anthony Hopkins. Anthony Hopkins said to the producer, who had asked him if he played in the theatre, said, absolutely not, I don't want to work in the theatre again. But if you want to do it on television, I'm your man. And so the producer came to me, and of course I hesitated for about 3 nanoseconds. And said, yes, please, and then asked Ian McKellen if he would do it. I was thrilled that he wanted to do it. Then everybody else came aboard, Edward Fox and Emily Watson and Sarah Lancashire and so on.
Brings up a couple of different things. First of all, in the special features part of the DVD, McKellen has said that he's always been offered the part of Sir, the main actor, and it was unusual for him to be offered the part and get to do Norman, the more sort of mousy, effeminate dresser character, and he leapt at the chance to do that instead. Am I right?
Yeah, absolutely true. And it was a great challenge because Ian's always been playing those strong protagonists. He always gets cast as, you know, Richard III is a famous characterization of his, and Gandalf, and it was such a thrill for him to be playing someone who was ostensibly meek and vulnerable and at times weak, but with a spine of pure steel.
I have to say, I've watched your version of The Dresser. I think they're both superb, and McKellen is just genius, I think, in the role. He's absolutely tremendous. How much do those two actors, considering their stature, allow themselves to be directed by you, as opposed to, this is what I want to do?
It was completely, it's almost embarrassing to say how pleasant and easy the whole process was. We rehearsed for 2 weeks, which is unusual in television. Because we only had 20 days to shoot the whole piece in for 2 hours, so we had a lot to get over, a lot of work to do, but 2 weeks rehearsal, and they were an absolute joy. And I wasn't directing them in the sense of, you've got to do this, you must do it my way. It was just, they both have so much was simply shaping and cultivating whatever it was that they offered me.
You're pretty well known for that Ian Holm Lear. Not to dredge up too much stuff, but you only realized much later on that he was kind of a distant version of your own father?
I did. Well, of course, I should have realized while I was rehearsing it, but it was when my sister came to see it, and she was shocked, and she said to me, "Why did you put our father on the stage? Why did you make Ian behave like our father?" And I said, "I never mentioned my father to Ian. I said, blame Shakespeare for creating this character who, astonishingly, was close to many domestic tyrants, which is certainly, my father had more than a bit of domestic tyranny in his character."
Well, I mean, he didn't run around naked the way, Holm got naked towards the end, but, or did he?
Didn't. No, but he was inclined to rages and inclined to pretty extravagant behavior.
Was he physically abusive or just mentally, verbally?
Only when I was a child. I wouldn't say he took me on as physically as an adult. But he'd had quite a brutal childhood, and in many ways he passed on the brutality to me.
And he didn't, at least to your face, ever appreciate your work in the theater. And yet, you had heard from somebody that he was actually proud of you? What was that all about?
What was that all about? I don't know, and it really was. What was extraordinary is that when he died, I sat beside his corpse, and I thought, the whole of my life, I've been signaling, trying to attract your attention, and now it's too late. And there was some sort of sense of pride in him that he didn't want to be seen as what he would have thought of as weakness in bestowing obvious approval on me.
So after he passed, did your idea of your career and what you wanted to do and how you wanted to go about it change? Were you freer in some way?
I think I was freer, but also in the wake of his death, I had a really severe depression. I think because I felt there was this completely unfinished, unresolved relationship, and I could now only communicate with him posthumously. And I found it very, very upsetting. And my mother had Alzheimer's, so that she was inaccessible. So there was no one of that generation that I could share my feelings with.
But in that state of depression, unlike a lot of people who kind of curl up in bed and sleep for a week, you had to work, right? Were you working through the whole thing?
I was, yeah.
How'd you get up every day and do that when clinically depressed people can't even move?
Yeah, but I think it's true of a lot of people who work to dig themselves out of depression. I think it's quite common. But of course, you get to a point where you can't and you've got to stop.
Now, do you have peaks and valleys now, or is everything, that was just a thing you went through and you never have to worry about it again?
The whole, I think any director will tell you that there's a sort of mild bipolar element in the whole life of a director, because you attach yourself to a project, you work very, very intensely on a project. The project is like, you know, the center of your universe, and you're circling around the project, and then the project ends and you find out that you've been in a parallel universe, and you emerge into the universe that's shared by everybody else on Earth. It's a shock, and you get a mild depression. You know, the ups are very intense and the downs are equally intense.
And is it true, I think,
into another project, and that assuages the depression?
Well, is it true still, I mean, at your level, and you still direct probably two or three or four things a year, be it opera or theater, do you still spend opening night sort of alone in a different space? You can't bear, you're too scared to be with the crowd in the audience?
I've got a little better. 60 years on that particular roller coaster.
Now, you're going to be directing a couple of operas at the New York Met in the weeks and months ahead. Because you have to balance really beautiful singing with acting, is that a real challenge that you don't face in musical theater or obviously regular theater?
It's often exaggerated because these days the younger singers are passionate about acting. I've got four productions which are in the repertoire of the Metropolitan Opera, and two of them are being revived in the next seasons, Manon Lescaut by Puccini and Verte by Massenet. And I did one of them last season and the other one three seasons ago with fantastic actor-singers or singer-actors. So I have no complaints about the acting of first-rate singers. But, of course, what I try and do and try and bring to opera is a naturalness. I try and bring something of the values of truthfulness of behavior to an art form which is very, very extreme and mannered.
Do you find there's a difference trying to direct men versus women? Or do you have to work a different way? Are they the same?
No, I'd say marginally that women are easier than men. But, you know, it depends on the individual.
In your memory, what are a couple of precious memories, Sir Richard Eyre, that you had in your 10 years at the National Theatre?
I would say doing a production of Guys and Dolls with Bob Hoskins and Julia McKenzie and Ian Charlton would be very high on my list, and doing an Ibsen play with Paul Scofield. Ooh. Paul was just a spectacular actor and very much missed. And I think of all the 20th century greats, I mean, Olivier, Gielgud, Richardson, Ralph Richardson, right, and yeah. Scofield. For me, Scofield was the greatest.
And people might not realize this, but you took some, to use an American word, guff, for trying to do Guys and Dolls way back when. It wasn't seen as being lofty enough for the National.
Oh, no, there was a lot of criticism because, you know, what is the National Theatre doing producing an American musical? To which I'd say the remit of the National Theatre is to present the best of world theatre. And the American musical is one of the great elements in world theatre history. It's a unique American invention. We have as much right and duty to perform that as we do to perform Greek tragedy.
Although there was some comment that once the floodgates opened with Guys and Dolls, the National almost became too much of a musical theatre house.
Yep, I think that's true. But I would rather that the floodgates had opened than they were still dammed up.
That's fair. Can I ask your thoughts on the current state of the RNT, the Royal National Theatre?
I think it's extremely healthy. It's now nearly 20 years since I left the National Theatre. There have been three directors. There was Trevor Nunn for 5 years, Nicholas Heitner for 12 years, and now Rufus Norris. And it's going in a very different direction. Rufus is absolutely of a different generation. What is happening is, I guess, very much what happened when I was director. I introduced a whole new generation of directors, designers, and actors to the National Theatre and to the National Theatre audience. And this is what Rufus is doing. So it has a very fresh feel. And what's very healthy about it is that he's not trying to replicate the successes of the past.
Good, that's how theatre keeps being relevant. I mean, Americans now can start to see British plays from the RSC, I think from the National too, just by going to their movie theatres or logging on to their computers and paying a fee. I mean, you just directed a telefilm of a play, which is different from cameras, live audience, boom. Are you pro, against, in the middle?
I'm pro in that it gets the news of theatre out far and wide. My only caveat is just reminding audiences that they're not seeing theatre. Because theatre, by definition, you have to be in the same place and at the same time as the actors. You have to share the space, and it has to be in the present tense. So when you're watching on television, it's a hybrid. It's part TV, it's filtered through the television screen. It's not theatre, it's a TV version of theatre. That, I think, needs to be said. Audiences need to be reminded of it. I mean, they may say they're perfectly aware of it, but I'm the perfect example of somebody who was infected by going to live theatre when I was nearly 16. I'd never seen a play in a theatre, and somebody took me to see a play, and the play was Hamlet, and the actor was Peter O'Toole.
Oh, good Lord.
And I was capsized by the whole event, and I never looked back from that day.
Which is kind of good, because your first role was before that, wasn't it, in an operetta?
Yes.
Come on, you've got to share, you've got to tell.
Gilbert and Sullivan. My role, I was at the age of 13, I was in Pirates of Penzance.
But you weren't the Pirate King or anything like that, you were?
I was one of the girls.
Well, okay. Had your voice not changed yet, or? I'm just wondering.
I wouldn't say that made me fall in love with theater.
I would imagine not. But 3 years later, boom, it happened, seeing Peter O'Toole in Hamlet, I can get that. Now, in recent years, as a spectator to the theater, what are one or two shows, plays or musicals, that knocked you out in recent times?
Let me think. Well, recent times, Hamilton, I would say, was the biggest knockout. I saw at last year at the Public Theater, before it transferred to Broadway, and I thought that was spectacularly wonderful piece of theatre.
Haven't heard of that. Hamilton, it's called? I'm kidding. Okay, yes.
Hamilton.
Yes. Okay. And what's something we might not know, or something you saw across the pond? Your pond. Yeah.
I've recently seen a play called People, Places, and Things, which is a really, really intense play about an alcoholic, a woman in and out of rehab, and it sounds very grim, but it's wonderfully moving and redeeming and humane piece of theatre. Hi, this is Richard Eyre, director of theatre, opera, and movies, talking to Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By.
Can I ask, you have described yourself, and you probably still are, a fairly shy person. So when you step into the rehearsal room, do you take on a new persona of front stage face, or are you still sort of shy-ish?
No, in a rehearsal room, I'm kind of shamelessly unshy.
Oh.
I find that I feel released from a sense of public exhibition of myself, and I love the frankness of a rehearsal room and the ability to share thoughts and feelings with people, with actors, with the absolute certainty that whatever you say, it's not going to carry outside the rehearsal room. I guess it's like you must have meetings in your job where people confess things to you, talk about themselves.
Well, not confessions, that's the wrong religion, but yeah.
You guarantee a confidence.
Without mentioning names, unless they're dead and you can talk about them, have you had any actors who were just impossible, and what did you do?
Now, I've never had an actor I would have thought was impossible. Many years ago, I was making a television film with the great Wendy Hiller, Wendy Hiller.
From Pygmalion, etc., yeah?
Absolutely. And she started, we did a day or two's rehearsal before we started filming, and she started to play the part. We were doing a scene, and I must have looked horrified, because she stopped and said, "Is there something wrong?" And I thought, oh, I'm never going to be able to say it. And I said, well, look, I'll be honest, this just isn't how I think the character is written. And we talked about it a bit, and she suddenly said, oh, thank then she said, let me try it again. I do want to be good, you know. And I think really that's true of any... An actor is a fool or a bad actor if they don't believe that, if they don't want to be good. And so underneath every insecurity, there is the desire to excel, and you just, as director, have to find a way of making it possible for them to be as good as they can be, or surprise themselves and be better.
Shows, especially on Broadway and places like that, tend to be frozen after opening night. Have you ever had a show where it was all right, but you knew it could be better? Could you still work on it, or did you have to just shrug your shoulders, turn away, and move on to the next project, knowing, oh, if I had three more days rehearsal, this would be so much better?
Well, I think the example would be Mary Poppins, which is I first did 12 years ago, and we opened out of town in Bristol and came to London. It's just finishing a regional tour in the UK, and it's changed vastly over the years, and every time that it's done, we change something and improve it, and that's a huge privilege. So this show, which played for 6 years on Broadway, is currently playing in Vienna and going to play in Hamburg. It just keeps improving it. It's a great privilege to be able to return to. When you have a short rehearsal period, sometimes it's exasperating that you open and you feel, oh, we haven't really had time to do our work properly.
We've been talking with Sir Richard Eyre mostly about the director-actor process, but when you're dealing with a new play, you have to work with a playwright. And how much is expected of you to kind of shape the work, even before it gets on stage? Like, you're looking at the script and delicately telling a playwright, you know, you're building to something here, but it doesn't pan out. Or how does that relationship work?
I love working on new plays. I've worked with a great number of playwrights. It kind of depends who the writer is. I mean, I've worked with Tom Stoppard, and Tom will ask my opinion, but I'm not telling him how to rewrite the play any more than with David Hare, who I've worked with a great deal, or Christopher Hampton. But with an inexperienced playwright, often you're saying, the playwright will say, well, what should I do? And you're saying, well, you know, this could be better if we do X, Y, and Z. And then it's a debate. I'm never in the position of ordering a writer, and particularly a writer in the theatre. It's not like writing for cinema, where the whole strata of people you have to deal with, producer, financiers, distributors, exhibitors, and so on, who all want to pitch in. In the theatre, writers write for the theatre because they feel their voice is heard and they're not going to be pushed around. So you share.
Now, we're talking about the theater and also cinema. What about television? We didn't even mention that for a few years, you were on the board of governors of the BBC. What did you actually do?
I was.
Yeah, what did you do there? What did that mean? And what were some of the funny or strange or interesting experiences that you had doing that?
Well, I had worked for the BBC from 1978. I was 3 years. I produced a strand of new drama called Play for Today, dramas which had a remit to be controversial, to be contemporary and controversial, which is a remit much to be envied these days. Then I guess it was 1993 that I joined the board of the BBC, and it was thrilling but exasperating, because having worked in broadcasting, I found I was the only person on the board, which is a board appointed by the government of the day, who had actually worked in broadcasting. And so often, say, there would be incidents where people would say, oh, this is disgraceful, this shouldn't happen this way. And I would say, there is no conspiracy. Things happen. This is the way, think of your own lives. This is the way things happen. It's much more frequent, the cock-up theory of history than the conspiracy theory. So I was able to be the sort of the voice of the broadcaster, the maker of programs on the board, but with a responsibility to the collective view of the board. I wasn't on the board for a famous incident, which was when the Iraq war, just before the Iraq war, when a BBC journalist was accused by the government of giving false information. And there was a huge row, which it ended with the sacking of the then Director General of the BBC. I missed that by about a month. Rather galled by that.
It's interesting how you're implying that television has become more tame and not taking the chances on drama. And yet, at least on this side of the pond, we've seen the last maybe 15 years as being a second golden age of television, where this medium has superseded even film and theater.
Oh, I think that's true, and I think HBO really led the field on that.
And let's not forget Stars, because.
Absolutely.
Stars did a nice little program called The Dresser, featuring Emma Watson and Sir Anthony Hopkins and Sir Ian McKellen, directed by the person that we are talking to, Sir Richard Eyre. Everybody, you can get the DVD, has just been released this week, so everybody please go and get that. Let me ask you, Sir Eyre. That's just weird calling a person Sir. I didn't even do that.
Just call me Richard, please.
Really? Okay. Richard, you can call me Sal. When you have directed so many shows, and especially classics, like a Chekhov or like Shakespeare, especially if it's fairly soon after you've directed a piece, and then you see another production of it, can you sit there and just watch it as a person, as a theater lover, or are you always going in your head, I did it that way, or should have done it that way, or, why isn't he doing that?
Generally, yes, I am thinking that.
But
I'm
really
equally thinking, I wish I'd thought of that. So it's if you see a piece you know very well, it is impossible, I think, to be completely even-handed about it. You're always going to be partial because you've been very, very closely attached to the piece yourself. So it would be, I think, impossible and inhuman to be utterly objective.
Speaking of objectivity versus subjectivity, are you convivial during the process of either a movie or theater, maybe less, of going out for drinks and food with the actors, with the playwrights, or do you sort of have to be aloof and not play favorites and not go out and eat with the stars and things like that?
No, I can't do aloof.
Oh.
I'm no good at aloof. Convivial, I'm definitely convivial is me.
Is it that kind of thing that you were talking about, though, when you go through a big production of anything, and then you have that depressive point when it's all over, but do you stay in touch as a friend with the folks you've worked with, or do years go by and then you think, they would be good for a piece I'm doing, and then, boom, you call their agent and, they're back?
A bit of both. I've made a lot of friends working. A lot of actors are my friends who have become friends when I worked with them. I guess a bit of both. And some people who I'm very close to when I'm working with them, then for various reasons I haven't seen for years, and then we'll call up and say, there's this great part for you, will you do it? And sometimes they say no, which is a terrible
Well, I also see it from perhaps the actor's perspective. I mean, if they know you, if you're kind of friendly, and they know that you're working on different things all the time, is there that sort of sense where they don't want to ask you, but they're kind of hoping every time they call you or see you, it's like, you're working on anything? Is there a little something for... How do you avoid that?
Yeah, there's no way of avoiding it.
Okay.
And it's better when actors say directly, is there a part for me? Which is always whatever I say I'm working on, Ian McKellen will always say to me, is there a part for me? Which is great.
Do you still audition, or do you generally get people that you know they're great and you don't bother? You let, like, a casting director deal with all the minor parts.
Oh, no. I cast every part.
Wow.
The generations of actors who I don't know and haven't worked with. So, sure, I audition, and it's thrilling. You know, I've just been auditioning 20-year-old boys for the movie that I'm doing in the fall. And, of course, you know, I've never met or seen them before, and most of them have never worked.
Right. And can I ask you about acting style? Since you've been directing for a few decades now, is acting, are the tools that people are coming in with, different from what they were in the 60s and 70s?
Yeah, I think this is a strange thing, that acting styles change over generations. And you would think that they remain consistent. After all, I'm not sure that human beings have changed that much over the centuries. But there's no question that the acting styles of today, it's much more casual, it's much more, I guess, closer to behavior you see all around you. It's much less extreme. But yeah, I think it's a question of fashion. When, for my generation, Marlon Brando was absolutely the be-all and end-all. I thought then, and I think I still do, that he was the greatest movie actor ever.
Movie actor,
but
okay.
I think if you said to a 20-year-old now, you know, that's the best actor ever, they'd say, well, I don't know. And they'd probably quote somebody who is, you know, who means the same for their generation, who... I would say, yeah, but he's not nearly as good as Brando. So it's very unpredictable. It's very much a question of fashion and timing and the way each generation wants to carve out their own icons.
And I'm thinking that maybe also microphones have something to do with it, that even in plays, not just in musicals, everyone now is mic'd.
I think that's true. And, of course, 30 years ago, almost every actor who was appeared on TV or in films had served a kind of apprenticeship in the theatre. And that's not true now at all.
Hmm. So when you get a theatre person and you're doing a television piece with them, do you kind of have to work with them a little bit to tone it down? They don't have to play to the back row now. They just have to play, you know, 10 feet away from a camera?
Not really, because they'll have sucked that up with their mother's milk.
Interesting. So maybe it's the other way around. When you get TV people and you're bringing them to the stage, it's like, hey, even though you're mic'd, we have to hear you. Yeah?
That's very, very true. And it's a sort of philosophical thing as well as a technical thing. We have to hear you. That's to say, if I'm sitting the back row of the orchestra stalls, I want to not only to hear you, but for you to express yourself to me. And that's often very difficult for young actors who have never been on a stage. And they think it's inherently untruthful to project yourself. But, you know, it's all untruthful on one level. You're not actually experiencing whatever that you're performing. You're pretending to experience it. It's an act of pretense. You're pretending to spontaneity. And that's how I measure your skill. How good are you at pretending to be spontaneous?
Is there a play that you have never directed that you really, really want to and you hope you will get the chance in the next 5-10 years or so?
Yeah, well, I've never directed Shakespeare's Twelfth Night.
Really?
Which is a play I really love.
Why has that... I mean, you had the choice. I mean, you're in a position where you could have done that any time over 30 years. Why not?
I don't know. I don't know. But somehow it's just slipped through my hands. I'm very sorry.
Well,
it has.
Well, maybe you'll get a chance. I mean, you know, you can still do it.
Much hope so.
I hope so, too, and I want to thank you so much for expressing yourself and projecting yourself with us here in the neighborhood. We've been talking with Sir Richard Eyre. He is the director of the new DVD, the new teleplay version of Ronald Harwood's The Dresser. It's available from Starz, S-T-A-R-Z, their video series. So go get it. It's quite marvelous. I have seen it. Also, he's going to be directing a movie in the fall with Emma Thompson in it. Does it have a name yet?
Yeah, it's called The Children Act.
The Children Act. It'll be, and that will be a feature film, right?
It's a feature film, yes.
And also, if you're in New York and you can get to the Metropolitan Opera, he's got Manon Lescaut and like four other operas or three other operas in repertory. What an amazing career, not just that this man has had, but continues to have. And my last question for you, Richard, is if you could ask William Shakespeare any question, what would it be?
You know, I'd love to ask him if he'd fought in a war, if he, at any point in his life, been in an army, because in every play of his, almost all his protagonists are military people. King Lear, Macbeth, Hamlet's father, Claudius, Othello, all the history plays, and he seems to brilliantly understand the fighting man and the whole business of war, and I just want to ask him, how did you acquire that knowledge?
Huh.
That's one of 3,000 questions I'd like to ask.
It's a really good one, though. I've got to say that. Well, speaking of acquiring knowledge, and actually, all right, I'm going to ask another half a question. Do you have any plans to write any more books? Because you've written a book about the history of the theater, but what about your history?
I published a book last year, which is a book of essays and interviews with writers and public people.
What's it called?
No, I don't have at the moment. I don't have an idea for a book.
Okay, that book of essays and thing. What's it called?
It's called What Do I Know?
Well, you know an awful lot, Richard, and I'm again very, very honored and pleased that you have shared some of that with us here in the neighborhood. I wish you success with the film, with the operas, with all the other projects that you have ahead of you in all the different media. And just thank you again so much for being with us in the neighborhood.
Thank you.
Shalom to you.
So much, Saul.
Shalom. Thank you.